Welcome to the Future of Political Consulting by the AAPC, where we explore the evolving landscape of political consulting in a rapidly changing world. The AAPC is a bipartisan membership organization that represents professionals working in the political consulting industry. Our host today is Jill Normington, partner at Normington Peltz & Associates and member of the AAPC Board of Directors. Jill has more than 20 years of experience in survey research and campaign strategy. She will be leading the discussion with Dr. Jennifer Lawless, a professor of politics and public policy at the University of Virginia. Jennifer's research focuses on political ambition, campaigns and elections, and media and politics. She will bring her wealth of knowledge to discuss the barriers women face in political consulting, the importance of mentorship and representation, and the shifting voter dynamics that consultants must understand to succeed in the future. Together, they will examine the role of women in political consulting, past, present, and future. Jill, take it away.
Good morning, Jen. It's nice to meet you. I thought I would start in the most general sense by asking you two questions, really. It's one question, really, in two parts. One, can you just give us an overview of what your research has told you? And then for me, as a researcher, I'm kind of interested in the methodology behind how you can, you know, reach the conclusions that you reach. So you can answer those in any order you want, but, you know, walk us through what your research generally says.
Sure. Thank you for having me and good morning. I have been studying questions of the gender gap in political ambition for more than 20 years. And basically, what Richard Fox and I have done is compile national samples of people that we consider potential candidates. So these are lawyers, business leaders, educators, and political activists. And we've conducted national surveys and supplemented those surveys with in-depth interviews to ask people whether they've ever considered running for office, whether they've been recruited to run for office, whether they think they're qualified to run for office. And the logic behind setting up these studies this way is that on paper, the women and men are exactly matched. So we're coming up with comparable samples of lawyers, comparable samples of business leaders, of educators, of activists. These men and women have similar levels of political interest, similar levels of political participation. Their incomes and educational backgrounds are matched. And so we're really able to home in on differences in interest in running for office. And when we did the first study in 2001, we uncovered a 16 percentage point gender gap in political ambition. And by that, I mean that women were 16 percentage points less likely than men ever to have considered running for office for any position whatsoever. They were also about 50% less likely to do any of the things that are typically required to run, like talk to party leaders or figure out how much money it would cost or engage with a political consultant, talk to experienced candidates. Fast forward, and in 2011, we did another survey, basically the exact same questions, brand new sample of people set up the same way, but it's like the next generation of potential candidates. And during this 10-year lag, a lot of relevant political changes had happened. Women had become major players on the national stage. Hillary Clinton almost won the 2008 presidential nomination. Sarah Palin was a vice presidential candidate. Nancy Pelosi was elected Speaker of the House. We also had very high profile women running political campaigns. And what we found was that the gender gap in ambition remained exactly the same size. And then fast forward to 2021 and 2022, we decided to do this once again. And here, really, we had undergone a sea change in politics. We saw the election of Hillary Clinton. She received the nomination. She received more votes than Donald Trump did, although she didn't win the presidency. She got higher than any woman had ever climbed. We saw the election of the first female vice president in Kamala Harris. Nancy Pelosi was Speaker of the House again. And the percentage of women in Congress had actually doubled from the time that we did our initial study. So we were confident that that gender gap in political ambition was going to close, and it remained exactly the same size. And what's really interesting is that across this 20-year period, when women run for office and when women ran for office 20 years ago and even 30 years ago, they're just as likely as men to win their races. They even raise the same overall amounts of money, and their media coverage is looking increasingly similar. But there's this very, very tenacious, sticky, stubborn gender gap in political ambition, where even though we're seeing an uptick in the number of very high profile women running, the political system in general doesn't seem more inclusive to women than it did even 20 years ago. So that's basically how I spend all my time.
And what does your research say is that barrier to get over that, whatever that first hurdle is? What does your research say about that? What is that barrier?
So there are two big factors that have played a role, and these factors have played a role consistently over time. The first has to do with external forces and political recruitment. Women who exist in the same political circles as men, who are just as politically active, who are basically just as politically well-connected, are not recruited to run for office at the same levels as men. And by recruited to run, I mean by party leaders, elected officials, or by political activists. But they're also less likely than men to receive the suggestion or the prodding to even consider a candidacy from their family members, colleagues, and friends. And so women aren't getting that external push. And as a result, they're less likely to think about it. You know, if nobody suggests that you ever be an astronaut, chances are you're not going to even think about becoming an astronaut. The second reason is more internal, although it's related. And that's that even though these women and men on paper look exactly the same, they don't self-assess the same way. And women are far more likely than men to consider themselves not at all qualified to run for office. And men are almost 50% more likely than women to consider themselves very qualified to run. Even though when we ask about specific qualifications and specific things they do at work that could be politically relevant, like public speaking or raising money or organizing events, there are no gender differences. So it really is perceptual. And when we've delved deeper, we found that it's because women, and frankly, men, think that women have to be twice as good to get half as far in politics. So their bar of what a qualified candidate is completely different. And so although it's true that when women run for office, they're just as likely as men to win both primaries and general elections on both sides of the aisle, the reality is people don't think that. And so if you don't know that that's actually what's happening, and if you don't know those are the aggregate level outcomes, and if you do see these high profile examples of bias and sexism in politics, thinking that you'd have to be twice as good to get half as far is a rational response to a political environment that looks like it's rife with sexism.
It sort of reminds me of something that I read at just one of those little factoid things that pop up from time to time about, you know, do you think you could land a plane in a crisis? And like, you know, 8 out of 10 men said, oh, yes, I could definitely land a plane in a crisis. And like 2 out of 10 women said they could land a plane in a crisis. And the reality is probably none of them could land a plane in a crisis.
That's exactly that same
sort of sense of just different levels of confidence are really what's barring people. I wonder if you think that the same thing is true. Have you done any research onto the other side of politics, the side that, you know, this organization represents, about women going into, you know, working on politics, working on campaigns, working on issue advocacy? Has your research covered any aspect of that, or is it focused solely on candidate work?
So the bulk of our research focuses on potential candidates, but we have done studies, especially a study that we did about 10 years ago of high school and college students, where we asked them about their career aspirations and ambitions. And we asked them about the best ways they thought they could be effective in changing the world. Because what we found was that young people were really, really interested in making a positive change in their communities, their nation, and even globally. But they didn't think that electoral politics was the way to do it. They did think that working behind the scenes, either for candidates or particularly for issues, was a much more effective route, in part because they look at the political system, and again, in part because of our news environment, they only see the failures. They only see men behaving badly. They only see things not working out. It's not newsworthy to say that a bill that nobody really thinks much about, but that makes sure that, you know, X functions this way, got passed today. That's just not something that garners much coverage. So it seems like, at least for this next generation, there is this interest by women and men alike to work for other candidates, to work as political consultants, to understand the way the political system operates, to figure out the best ways to win, whether it be a political campaign for a candidate or for an issue. And that represents a change because 20 years ago, the overwhelming majority of people that were working as political consultants, and certainly those who were climbing the political career ladder, were men. So we are seeing improvement on that front. But frankly, I think the political environment broadly construed is a tough sell in general right now, and especially to women.
Sure. So I'm wondering if there are, if some of those ambition effects go away the older that you get. My experience, I work with a lot of women candidates and I work with a lot of first-time candidates, is I have a lot of women in their late 40s or their early 50s who say, like, I'm ready now. My kids are grown now. They don't need me as much now. So it's a phase of life issue for so many women who are a little bit older, who feel like part of their responsibility is just in a different place now. Do you see any of those changes go away once we start getting to, you know, midlife?
I'm really a dark cloud here. I'm like, the glass is entirely empty. So, you know, to forecast the answer, although I'll elaborate, is no. So two things. The first is that over these generations where there actually has been a shift in traditional gender roles and responsibilities with family, both household tasks and childcare, we've seen over this 20-year period, men move toward a more egalitarian household structure, or at least report that. Women still report doing the overwhelming majority of the household work and childcare. Men either have gotten a little bit better or now at least know that it's not socially acceptable to admit that they do nothing, which, you know, somehow indicates some degree of progress. But over these generational shifts, we haven't seen any real change at this base level of ambition. And then within each of these cohorts, within each of these samples, older people are more likely to consider running for office, but that's true for men too. And so the gender gap in political ambition is the same size. So the glasses half full version of that is, as people get older, including women, they're open to more experiences. They probably do have more of a push to do something important in their communities if that's where they're being, you know, if that's where their energy is focused. But it's not going to fundamentally shift the ratio of women and men who are interested in throwing their hats into the ring. The second thing that I would say that's particularly jarring is that among college students, the gender gap in political ambition is actually bigger. And so it's about 20 percentage points among people who are in college. Now, that 20 versus the 16 isn't an incredibly dramatic difference, but it's certainly not the direction we'd want to be going in. And if at a point in your life when you actually don't have family responsibilities, you don't have a situation where you haven't figured out how to reconcile a job and home life and your friends and your hobbies, everything seems like it's open to you. If at that point in time, which is in a lot of ways the easiest time to at least be open to something, women are systematically less likely than men to say that politics is at least on their radar screen, I think we have a lot of work to do.
So, how do you reconcile the big increase that we see in real life with there are more women office holders, both at the local level and at the national level than we've ever seen before? How do we reconcile the data that tells us, you know, the ambition gap hasn't changed between women and men, and the reality of there being more women in the political space than there easily were 20 years ago?
Right. That's a question that I get a lot because I share these data and people say, have you not looked out the window? Like, what are you talking about? This is not the way the world works anymore. We see Liz Cheney. We see Lauren Boebert, Marjorie Taylor Greene, Kamala Harris, Elise Stefanik. There are so many high profile women.
Right.
Two reasons. The first is that we have 435 members of the House and 100 members of the Senate and a vice president and a president. So there are 537 federal elected officials in this country. If we wanted as a nation to have 100% of them be women, we could strategically recruit and do a pretty good job identifying women who could win of both parties in every single district. We have 500,000 elected offices in this country,
right?
More even. And we have hundreds of millions of people. So it's possible. It's just a simple math issue, right? It's possible to, at the highest levels of politics and even in localities, do a much better job recruiting in targeted ways handfuls of women and a shift in 10 or 20 of them in any given one election cycle looks like a sea change in our overall numbers when it comes to representation. But that means that we can do that with relatively minimal effort and not fundamentally change the underlying dynamics that still make politics not that appealing to women more broadly. So I think what the research is indicating, and this is not something we expected 20 years ago. 20 years ago, we expected a complete relationship. If we had more women elected, those effects would trickle down and we'd have more women run. What the newer data are showing us is that there really is a difference between representation and electing women and political ambition. So as long as there are some politically ambitious women out there and their ambitions are targeted and channeled, we can really close the gap when it comes to numeric representation. But that doesn't mean that we can close the ambition gap. The second thing is,
Finish.
The second thing is that it's possible that as we, and it's hard to measure this, but as we've seen more and more women succeed in politics, we've also seen more and more cases of high profile gender bias and discrimination and episodes of this. Not where it necessarily keeps a woman from winning an election, but people see how women are treated. People see how women in politics are often held to different standards. And there's sort of an irony there in that the more women we elect, the more examples of this we see. So there's sort of this representation paradox. And that might be playing a role too, or at least offsetting some of the positive symbolic effects of electing more women.
Leaving the gender gap aside for a second, how many people in general are politically ambitious? Like, what is that number of people who are just interested in running in the first place?
If you just ask a general national population of Americans, the numbers are generally about 8 to 10%. Okay. So that's pretty low. We didn't feel comfortable drawing conclusions based on a national sample because the overwhelming majority of people never even think about it. And I should note, too, that our question is, have you ever considered running for any office? It can even be a fleeting thought, right? So this is a very low bar for ambition.
That is a low bar.
And still, you're only getting 8 to 10%. So what we've done in our studies is focus on these potential candidates who are working in the four professions that are most likely to lead to political careers. And there, overall, about 50% of people have considered it. Yeah,
what,
so you've got
four major professions.
So law, business, education, and politics. So they're broad professions. We, for the 2021-2022 sample, expanded the sample beyond that. We also included several thousand people who work full-time and have college degrees but don't work in those four professions because we are seeing a push toward, you know, more diversity in terms of where people are coming from. And there, the overall baseline number of people who had considered it is lower. It's about 35%. But still, that means that people who are pretty well situated, these are the backgrounds that state legislators and members of Congress tend to have at least thought about it. Now, when it comes to whether they've actually done it, those numbers are much smaller. Only about 10% of the people in our sample have ever done it. And that includes running for like a local party position. So we're not talking about 10% of people in our sample who ran for state legislature or mayor or Congress, but they at least did put themselves forward.
Interesting. So let's think about this in ways that of, you know, how we change some of these things. A lot of us, hopefully, who are listening to this, part of our job is to go out there and find people. What do we do as consultants to change some of these dynamics?
One thing is to continue doing everything that you're doing, because I think that the reason women win at the same rates as men is because of the people who are working on their campaigns and helping them navigate a political environment that does seem tricky and that traditionally hasn't been welcoming to women. And so the fact that women win at the same rates as men, despite sexism, despite discrimination, despite perceptions of these challenges, is a testament to all of the political consultants out there who are helping women figure out the best ways to raise money, the best messages that they can promote, who are identifying the best candidates. So I don't think we need a sea change in terms of anything that's currently being done. That's part of the reason that we're seeing success at the end stage of the process. At the earlier stages of the process, encouraging women to run and really meaning it, I think, is the biggest challenge. So we've interviewed hundreds of women and men in addition to doing these quantitative surveys. And a pattern that comes up over and over again and came up just as frequently in the summer of 2023 when we did our latest round of interviews as it had in 2003 is that women who have actually been encouraged and recruited to run don't believe it. So we had meetings, we had interviews. I interviewed this woman who said that she had never been recruited to run. She didn't think she was qualified. And over the course of our interview, she mentioned that she had recently had a meeting with the mayor and he suggested that she run for city council. And so I was just like, what are you talking about? You just said that nobody ever suggested that you run for office. And she said, oh, I don't really think he was serious about it. And so part of it is conveying this sense that, no, 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 we mean it. And by the way, we've interviewed men who have told recruitment stories, like literally being recruited by a bartender at an airport, right? So the bar there is much, much different as well. So I think encouraging women, and when they look at you with a raised eyebrow or they sort of in a self-deprecating way dismiss themselves, continuing to follow up, right? Like no in this case doesn't really mean no. I think a lot of the time it means, oh my gosh, this has never even occurred to me. Tell me more. But I'm not sure that women are articulating it that way. So the extent to which political leaders and political consultants can make that push matters. The other thing that I would say is, although there are these high profile episodes of bias, and when people look at how Hillary Clinton or Kamala Harris is treated, there are a million reasons to decide not to throw your hat into the ring. I think it's really important too, to convey to women that that's not what a typical run for school board looks like. You know, people are not rifling through your trash. People, you're not on national television. You're not having to give a speech in front of 50,000 people. You don't need to do nationally televised debates. And people conflate all levels of office. And I think they assess whether they'd be qualified through this national lens through which basically no one is qualified to run. And then the third thing that I would say is highlight the positives. And we've seen a lot of work that has suggested, you know, that when women are reminded about the policy change that they can make in a community, that they're more inclined. But I think even highlighting the positives about what goes on in a campaign could really play a role. I ran for Congress in 2006. I lost. I ran in a Democratic primary in Rhode Island. And to this day, that campaign was the most meaningful experience of my life. And meeting people and hearing about the struggles that they're enduring or the successes that they've been able to achieve because of a government program or because of an elected official or because of the political system is something that sticks with you forever. And I don't think that we do a sufficient job conveying that more broadly. People's attitudes toward campaigns are incredibly negative. More than half of the people that we've surveyed and interviewed, men and women alike, have said that various aspects of a campaign would serve as deterrents to actually running for office. And so highlighting the good that can come of it, regardless of the outcome, I think is an attractive way to begin thinking about getting more people involved.
So if I'm going to boil that down into the three things we want to, you know, recruit more women into running for public office, one of them is to be persistent. Right. Say, it, in fact, yes, we do mean it. I do want you to run. That's number one. Number three is you have to remind people of why, you know, the loftier side of what politics is about, the ability to affect the kind of change that you'd like to see, whether it's in your local community or nationally. And what's the middle one? Say the middle one for me again.
It's not like running for president.
It's right to make it a little bit more realistic. It doesn't really look like what you think it looks like. I think you every time I see a political campaign on television, I always, you know, laugh out loud. You know, one time in Parenthood, I think this woman was running for local city council and they went to her campaign office and there were like 18 people working in her campaign office. And I was like, nope.
I know that episode.
That is not what a city council race looks like. There are not 18 people working for you. You don't have a team of people around you. It's like you and three of your friends printing out walk lists.
And even frankly, running for Congress, I mean, this was a real campaign, raised hundreds of thousands of dollars. There were televised debates. But I remember being so worried about not being a policy expert on every single issue. And I studied and I learned and I was going to be the smartest candidate that anybody ever met, which, by the way, is not the candidate anybody wants to meet. But putting that aside, during the debates, which were the two times that we had the most nuanced discussion of policy, I never had to speak about any one issue, literally for more than 45 seconds. And so I think conveying, and that's for the U.S. House of Representatives, right? So I think conveying the realities and the idea that there are a lot of things that you can learn as you're running and as you serve is something that just sort of comes naturally to how men think. And it's not the way that women do. And what's particularly interesting to me is that the women and men we've studied have already demonstrated high levels of success in traditionally male environments. They've already demonstrated that they are very ambitious. They've already demonstrated that they know how to navigate these tricky waters, yet they think of politics as so much worse. And so that is the challenge. How do we make politics seem not worse than corporate America, not worse than the legal field, not worse than higher education when it comes to these kinds of dynamics?
Interesting. Okay, so where can we find some silver lining in your data? Where can we find some maybe trends that are going in a direction that we might prefer?
The most hopeful is that when women are recruited to run, they're just as likely as men to respond positively to that recruitment. So we know that this works. It's not a matter of you recruit a woman and she's still going to say no. She has the same likelihood as a man of moving forward once she realizes that you mean it. And so that's a very, very concrete step, and it's positive. Linked to that, being encouraged to run by a family member, colleague, or friend gives you that same push that being encouraged by a party leader, elected official, or political activist does, at least to start thinking about it. Now, turning that thought into an actual candidacy does involve more in terms of the party leaders, the elected officials, and the political activists. But having that idea appear on your radar screen in the first place, anybody sitting next to you can do that. And I think that that's something that we need to realize. We need to start encouraging people, but that's hopeful. And then the other thing that I would note that I actually view as a positive is that although women don't consider themselves qualified to run for office, they also don't think that the men out there are qualified to run for office. So they're not. Okay. So the upside there is, I think it allows us to explain that, okay, but they're going to run anyway. So, you know, like at this point, if their reality is so different from our reality, what are we going to do about it? And if they're still putting themselves out there, and if women still think that those men are not qualified, that might actually help them realize that they might not be qualified, but they've been very successful. Maybe there's a way forward. So, you know, although the gender gaps that we've uncovered on all of these measures are pretty jaw-dropping, the good news is that when we close all of them, we know that women are just as likely to win. So I really think that doing whatever we can to promote the idea more to women is the way to go. And the example I always give is, you know, when young women weren't involved or weren't interested in science, there was a national outcry and STEM became a thing, both domestically and globally. We don't have that for politics because politics is not viewed as a noble profession the way that science is. The irony, of course, is that electoral politics is a way where you get stuff done and you set policy. And although there are a lot of upsides to working behind the scenes, if you're not working behind the scenes to elect somebody, or if you're not one of the people getting elected, you're really deferring those kinds of decisions to other people. And so, you know, politics should be seen as a noble profession. And if we can't encourage more women to get into it, then I worry that we're just going to have more stunted student body presidents running the world.
As I said previously, I do a lot of work with women candidates, particularly first-time women candidates, and that what you describe, you know, for your debate prep and wanting to be really prepared is a very common occurrence. You know, people, a lot of women who end up running for office are the way they solve problems is to intellectualize them so that if they're prepared enough, then that's going to reduce their overall anxiety level. And so at some point, as a consultant trying to help my client be the best that they can be, I anticipate this about so many of my women clients. We build in more debate prep sessions than I would for other people. We build in more, this is how what the policy looks like to keep their overall anxiety level down. It's one of the things as a consultant that I can do that I am aware it's part of the gender dynamics that take place. Are there other pieces of gender dynamics that we should, as consultants, keep in mind, not necessarily about recruitment, but about overall management? Are there other pieces like, you know, giving in to the idea that they need more prep sessions to feel good about themselves? Are there other things we should be thinking about as consultants?
I mean, it seems to me that the two big misperceptions out there, and I think that this is true for female candidates too, is the idea that it's much more difficult for women to raise money than men. And we know that at the end of the day, when you look at the campaign receipt totals, they're the same. Now, the sources might be a little bit different. It might be that it takes more phone calls to get that maximum contribution for a woman than a man, although I haven't seen systematic data on that. Okay. But the reality is, if that's the case, then women are even better than men at raising the money because they're making more of those calls to get the same number of dollars, right? And so I think sharing that information also, the same way that, you know, media coverage, as you know, in congressional races, for example, and certainly in down ballot races, local news is still the way that people get their information. And it's not about going on CNN. It's not about going on Fox News. It's about talking to the one local reporter who still works at your local newspaper. And Danny Hayes and I have done systematic analyses of local news coverage in midterm elections. And in terms of the volume and the substance of coverage, in terms of the specific traits mentioned in relation to a candidate, the specific issues mentioned in relation to a candidate, whether the candidate's appearance is ever mentioned, we found no gender differences. And so I think women also go in with this expectation that the media are going to be harder on them, that they're going to have to work harder to get coverage, that that coverage is not going to reflect what the campaign is about. And there's just not evidence of that either. Now, at the national level, that might be a different story in presidential politics. But, you know, the same way that we shouldn't be looking at the decision to run through a national lens, I think a lot of what candidates know or think they know about fundraising or media coverage is based on what they see nationally too. So to the extent that we can debunk those myths, it's really useful. One thing that I just wanted to add when you talked about, you know, building in additional debate time, I remember having a conversation with Stephanie Shriok at Emily's List a few years ago, and she and I were both sort of bemoaning the fact that there are now so many candidate trainings for women. Obviously, that's a good thing, but women sort of get on the hamster wheel of these trainings and yes, they want to take 900 of them before they think they're ready. And so we're in this catch-22 moment now where we have accommodated a lot of the self-doubts that women project to try and make them feel better equipped. But I worry that we've overcompensated so that it's possible now to just become a professional candidate in training.
That is a possibility. And as somebody who, you know, leads some of those trainings, I think that you can be right that we can create a cycle for people where they're just like, oh, one more, just like one more, and then I'll be ready. One more. Well, we have we've reached the end of our time together. I want to thank you so much for taking time out of your morning to walk us through your research and to give us maybe a little bit of hope. But what I'm hoping that people take away from this, because I assume that most of the people who are going to be listening are consultants like me, is some practical tips. Some real how-tos about how to go out there, how to recruit more women to run for office, the kinds of encouragement that women need, and how to successfully work with women clients when you have them on your roster. That is my hope for what people take away from this morning, is not just, you know, what the research says, but how to potentially close that gap.
Thank you so much. It was my pleasure.
That was our chat with Dr. Jennifer Lawless and Jill Normington. Don't miss an episode. Subscribe to The Future of Political Consulting by the AAPC on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And join the conversation by following us on social media at the AAPC. Thanks for listening.